Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Everyone, welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It is great to have you here, and it's Jesse Green at the controls as always today. Now, my guest today is someone who has spent a career in British intelligence, and throughout his career, he's provided advice to many different governments of all different political persuasions, and he's dealt with a lot of situations ranging from the Falklands War all the way through to and past the September 11 attacks. During his career, he's held many posts, but ultimately became head of the British GCHQ, which was responsible for gathering communication intelligence and advising the government on various matters. He's the author of a wonderful book called How Spies Think, and which I read about in Australia's Financial Review. And today we're going to be talking a lot about effective decision-making when you've got incomplete or even contradictory advice. So, Professor Sir David Armand, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's wonderful to have you. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your evening to come and talk to us.
It's great to be on your show. I was surprised to get an invitation to something called the Savvy Dentist, but now you've explained it, it all makes perfect sense. So very happy to have this conversation.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And it's interesting you say that, because when we invite people onto the show, we usually have to give a little bit of an explainer, because for most people not in the dental field, it probably seems from a little bolt out of the blue. So thank you again for making the time. I have your book on my Kindle and I've been reading it with complete fascination. And I must admit, I read an article in the Australian Financial Review. And at the time of reading the article, I was also reading another book by Ben McIntyre, which was The Traitor and the Spy. And it was interesting to go from reading that particular book to reading the synopsis of your book, which I've now read your book. And it makes me wonder what goes on in the world that, of course, we don't know about. And we'll touch on some of your stories later. But I wanted to begin our conversation by recounting the time when you received some intelligence about the Argentinian junta, which was contradictory to the previous intelligence. And it seemed from the more recent intelligence that that particular regime was likely to use force in the Falklands War to take those islands back by force. And you had to assemble that information, come to a conclusion. I'm wondering if you could take our listener through that scenario so they can get an idea of what a day in the life of an intelligence analyst was at that particular moment.
Well, I was working for the then Defence Minister, Secretary of State for Defence, John Knott. I was actually working in the Ministry of Defence, and John and I were working in his room in the House of Commons on a speech that he was, advising him on a speech he was going to give. In fact, to announce that the UK was going to purchase the Trident nuclear missile system. The last thing on our mind was what was going on in the South Atlantic. But as we were working, an officer came down from the defense, Dan Whitehall from the defense intelligence staff, with a locked pouch, which he kind of unlocked and pulled out these folders. And it was three decrypted signals from the Argentine Navy that GCHQ had picked up and had managed to decipher. No mean feat, I may tell you. And what they revealed was pretty startling, which was that an Argentine fleet had left port. There was a senior military officer on board. GCHQ had plotted the course and worked out that it looked like it was heading for the Falklands. And then the third one was that there had been a covert beach reconnaissance of the beach at Port Stanley, the capital of the Falkland Islands. Put those together and oops, it looks as if they've taken matters into their own hands and they're going to take over the islands. And this was on the Wednesday. And given the distances involved, that meant an invasion probably by the weekend. In fact, it turned out on the Friday. So John and I looked at each other and said, we'd better tell the Prime Minister. So we rushed down the corridor, and thankfully, Margaret Thatcher was in her office in the House of Commons. So we burst in and said, Prime Minister, you must look at this. So I explained what we thought this meant. And she looked up and said, this is very serious, isn't it?
Mm.
So there's only one reply to that, which is, yes, Prime Minister. She's very quick on the uptake, and she seized the import of this immediately and said, I must speak to the president. In other words, President Reagan, mm-hmm. recognizing that only a Reagan phone call to the junta could get them to call this off. There was no time to send reinforcements 7,000 miles to the South Atlantic. We fixed that through 10 Downing Street, but the junta wouldn't accept Reagan's call because they knew they'd get their arm twisted behind their back. Mm-hmm. So they just cut off contact. Meanwhile, they steamed towards the Falkland Islands, where there was really only a company of Royal Marines, no effective way of stopping them. So that evening, we had a rolling meeting in her room in the House of Commons as more of the great and good assembled to kind of worry about what on earth does one do in that kind of situation. And that's when the first Sea Lord, Admiral Sir Henry Leach, turned up in full uniform. And if you've ever seen an admiral in full uniform, it's quite impressive. He'd been presenting the prizes at a naval college. And he had, his staff had sent him to the House of Commons. So he turned up. And in very sailorly language, which I won't repeat on your podcast, said, what's the point of having an expletive deleted navy if you can't use it on this kind of occasion?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the idea of sending a Royal Naval Task Force to the South Atlantic came from. And she accepted that advice and prepared herself to make that public as soon as the invasion took place, which we were pretty sure was going to happen. And it duly did. And on the Saturday, she appeared in the House of Commons and made this announcement. The Foreign Secretary, Lord Carrington, resigned. There was a tremendous fuss. But I think having those couple of days' notice saved her government.
Mm.
Because if everyone had woken up to the knowledge of the invasion, including her, it would have been complete chaos. As it was, she was prepared, she was ready, she was ready to announce that we were going to send a task force to get them back, the islands back. And you know, that saved her bacon. But when we came to analyze it afterwards, it was clear that it was a major policy failure rather than an intelligence. It was an intelligence success to give her even a few days' notice.
Indeed.
Policy failure was leaving the islands undefended when, in fact, the Joint Intelligence Committee had said, look, if the junta comes to the conclusion that their discussions with the British government about the Falklands are leading nowhere, they may very well take matters into their own hands. But we hadn't done anything. The runway wasn't long enough to take jet aircraft. That's been fixed, by the way, following the invasion and its the recapture of the islands. So the islands are properly defended. But for the absence of spending that money then, preventatively, almost 1,000 lives were lost and billions of pounds spent recapturing the islands, all because we didn't pay attention to the strategic notice which we had that this was a possibility.
It's really interesting that you bring that up. And obviously, strategic notice ties into your SEAS model, which I'll come to in a moment. But I'm curious to ask about the policy failure. Obviously, somewhere someone had identified the risk that the Falkland Islands weren't as defensible or hadn't been prepared to be defended as well as they might. And I'm curious to ask, if that intelligence was there, what is it that stops people acting on what they know? Why did no one get the islands ready? Why did no one build the runway? What was the breakdown there?
I describe it in the book as magical thinking. And magical thinking is when, you know, the wish is father to the thought, as Shakespeare put it, where you want the world to be in a particular way, but you haven't actually done the hard work to connect that to real conditions on the ground. So the government simply, it's not they did ignore it, but more seriously, the government of the day they made an assumption that they'd always get warning. You know, this wouldn't come out of a blue sky. These things don't happen like that. We had very friendly relations with the Argentine nation, lots of British investment in Argentina, friendly trade relationships and all the rest of it. And there was just that sort of magical, well, it will never come to that, will it? And the junta, on the other hand, also had some magical thinking, which is that if we give history a nudge and take the place over, well, perhaps the Brits will be glad we took this problem off their hands. We're not going to face a real problem. And if the two sides had really thought through what it would take to make their wish come true, I mean, certainly on the British side, we would have spent a few tens of millions building a longer runway so we could reinforce very quickly, just fly troops in if it ever became necessary. Or we could even have stationed permanently a warship or a submarine. We did have submarines down there, but they were sent too late. I mean, they arrived at the time of the task force, but they weren't there when the invasion took place, sadly.
So there's a lot of things that I'd love to pick into there, but I'm going to resist the urge for the moment. I will definitely pick into them, but I wanted to talk about your SEAS model because I think it's a really important segue. You've spoken about strategic notice, and of course that is the fourth of the final S in the SEAS model. I'm wondering for our listener if you could provide a bit of an overview of that SEAS model, because I think it's really important to understand the thinking process that you've gone through as you're analyzing intelligence and using that process for other people to be able to make better decisions, whether it's in their business, in their personal life. And so we can perhaps stay away from that wishful thinking or that magical thinking, so we're not caught unaware, as it turns out. So could you please just provide us with a bit of an overview of that?
The question that was in my mind and I try to address in the book is, what really would you need to know to take a rational, evidence-based decision? It doesn't really matter if it's a decision to move house or change businesses or open a new business or indeed defend the nation. As a preliminary, let me just say that when we take a big decision, sort of two kinds of thought have to come together in our mind. There's our desires for what we want to achieve by our choice, or our fears over what we want to avoid by decision. And on the other hand, we've got the rational analysis of the situation we're facing, the options that may be open to us. And you need both kinds of thought. You need the passionate, values-driven, what ought to be and what I want, and the dispassionate bit, which I'm just coming to, which is what is and what are the limits of what can be. And both are necessary, and they've got to be integrated. And that's always been hard. But of course, in these days of social media and so on, it gets even harder. And that's why I came up with, for the rational part of it, saying we ought to strengthen our rational thinking. Mm-hmm. So I came up with this acronym, SEES, SEES, because that's what I hope a good analyst would do, would be to see. And the first S is situational awareness. So do you actually know what's going on, or are you relying on a bit of rumor, perhaps some fake information you picked up on social media? Do you actually have that ability to answer those questions that start with what and when and where? It's not as easy as it sounds to have that information, particularly if you're in the intelligence business. Where you look can govern what you see, fairly obviously. So if you're looking in the wrong place, it doesn't matter if it's a business decision or what kind of decision, you know, if you're looking in the wrong place, you're going to get information, but it may not be all the information that you need. And the other thing we know, and we sadly learnt this lesson once again in the run-up to the Iraq War, if you look hard enough, you can always find some evidence that appears to support your prejudice. So that's the first S, which is situational awareness.
I'm curious to ask you about looking in the right place just for a moment, because you're quite right when you say if we look in the right place, we'll find the information we need, but we sometimes look in the wrong place. The question I wanted to ask you is, how do we know where the right place is? And I understand that that comes with practice, experience, and perhaps having other people identify blind spots and so on, but how do you know when you're looking for, sometimes you don't even know what you're looking for. How do you know it's the right place?
It's very difficult to describe. There have been comparisons done between the medical practitioner, or perhaps in your case, you might say the dental practitioner, mm-hmm. and the presenting patient. So the presenting patient comes in and says, oh, I've got this terrible pain in my gut or whatever it might be. And the experienced clinician can draw on a lot of experience, mm-hmm. quite a lot of technical knowledge as well. Mm-hmm. And they actually, I'm going to send you for some tests mm-hmm. because I don't think it's in the gut.
Yes.
Or whatever it might be. That yes. But you have this combination of some quite deep training. You do need a certain amount of practical experience. And without consciously thinking it, the thought may bubble up saying, I've seen something like this before. Mm-hmm. And there's a bit of that in it. You also have to be systematic. The other thing is, I'll come to the next letter in the acronym, which is the E for explanation, is that you've got to look for some evidence that might contradict your wish, mm. as well as evidence that might support it. That doesn't come naturally to us as human beings. You know, we have these ideas. We're delighted when we see some evidence that appears to support our view. We don't necessarily go out looking and checking, but is there any evidence on the other side that might actually run against? And strictly, if you're trying to choose between a couple of hypotheses or idea, you should go for the one with the least evidence against it rather than the one with the most evidence in its favor, because of this unconscious, you know, we'll just get more and more evidence yes. to support our idea. I yes. mean, being cynical in the political sphere, you sometimes hear politicians talking about evidence-based policy. Actually, what they probably mean is, I've got a great idea and a policy. You go and find the evidence to support it. And that's not at all rational thinking. That's the opposite.
Of course.
So just come back to C's. So you've got some knowledge of the world. But my first lesson in intelligence is that our knowledge of the world is always fragmentary, it's incomplete, and you've got to accept it will sometimes be wrong. You can't guarantee you're going to get it right or understand what's going on. But if you've got some reasonable data, can you then jump to your conclusion? And the answer is no, you certainly can't. And this is one of the problems people get into. Technically, you'd call it the inductive fallacy. But facts need explaining. Little example, take a court. There's a young man up in front of the judge. His fingerprints were found on the fragments of a bottle mm-hmm. that were hurled at the police.
Yes.
Police patrol. Now, does that mean he threw it? Or did the mob, rushing past his house, pick up the bottle from outside his house where he'd left it for recycling? So you have two alternative explanations of the same unquestioned fact. His fingerprints were indeed on a bit of the bottle. And that's how defense lawyers make a living. They construct a narrative to explain the facts, and then the prosecution construct their narrative to explain it from their point of view, and the jury, in the end, if it's a serious case, the jury or the magistrate, if it's a lesser case, has to decide which of those narratives do I accept. And when you get into the world of big data, just because the data is correlated doesn't mean that one thing caused another.
Causes, yeah.
So, you know, correlation is not causation. So you need this explanation. So you've got to work out what are the likely explanations or hypotheses, if you want to be scientific, and test them against the data. And I say you're looking for the one with the least evidence against it. And obviously, getting explanations right is not easy. If you're talking about international affairs, then, you know, you need the language skills, you need the knowledge of the country. Just think about Afghanistan. You need the knowledge of the country concerned and its geography, its culture, all the rest of it, in order to be able to formulate a good explanation. Why did Russia, it would appear, use Novichok to try and murder Alexei Navalny? Yeah.
Good explanation.
But why did they use, you know, a prohibited nerve agent rather than just walking up to him with a pistol? And that's a fact which we think the Germans established, that it was indeed this prohibited nerve agent. Same in Salisbury in England, when Novichok was used to try and kill a former GRU officer. So why use such an extraordinary method? And that then takes you into understanding rather better the dynamics of what is actually going on in that sort of case. So if you've got a decent explanation, you can then move on to try and estimate how events might unfold. You don't want to jump from the facts on the ground straight to the, well, this is what's going to happen next. By the way, intelligence analysts, certainly in the UK, avoid the word prediction. There are no crystal balls. The future is utterly unknowable. You know, you just can't predict it. But you can estimate within certain boundaries and give probabilities and say it is very likely that, you know, as you would do, following this course of treatment is likely. There's no guarantee.
Of course.
So you don't predict, but you can estimate. And if you've got a good explanation, you've got enough data, you can even try modeling. So you can start saying, on the assumption of this, we would expect to see that.
Yes.
COVID-19 gives some very good examples of this. So the basic data, you know, where are the cases? Who are the cases? Where are they? Basic data. Then you've got the explanation of, from the scientists and the doctors about transmission of the disease. Is it contact? Is it aerosols? And so on. And on the basis of a good scientific explanation, they can then give government some models of, if you were to introduce a 2-meter rule to keep people apart or to introduce a quarantine or whatever it might be, this is the likely effect on different assumptions about how many people would follow the rules and so on. So you can see how logically you can bring together data, explanation, and then estimation. And the fourth letter, the final one, is quite different, because my experience is when you're head down, eyes down, and you're following this through, trying to work out what's going to happen next, something completely unexpected comes and hits you on the back of the head. So one of the outputs that a good analyst can give is just watch out for these kind of known unknowns, these black swans, whatever you want to call them, that there's no guarantee they'll happen. They may never occur. But if they did, they could be quite serious. So probably take your time. You might want to commission some research. You might want to make some contingency plans just in case these things happen. And again, COVID gives us a good example, or bad example, which is that we did have strategic notice in the UK of the risk from a new coronavirus. At the time when I was in the Cabinet Office, it was top of our risk register. We reckoned it would kill more people than any terrorist attack. We couldn't predict exactly what form it would take.
Of course.
That would be impossible. But if that threat warning, that strategic notice had been followed, then you might have expected the UK to have had proper stockpiles of protective equipment, to have plans for expanding track and trace and so on. As it was, we've had to kind of improvise and make that up as we went along. The good news, though, is the people who did take notice were the drug companies.
Yes.
They worked with the regulators to plan how would you shorten the time to produce a vaccine against an entirely new coronavirus. and they halved that time, as a result of which we have around the world a number of vaccines produced in record time, and certainly in the UK approved by our regulator in record time. Our European former partners, our friends in Europe, seem to take a very long time to get that kind of regulatory approval, which is the difference, I think, between a common law mindset and a Napoleonic code mindset. So if you're of the continental style, you look in the book and you have the precautionary principle. Have you got firm evidence? No, you haven't for giving the vaccine to the over 65s, for example, because that didn't come out of the trials.
Trials, yes.
So you have to say, no, I'm sorry, we can't pass it. The common law approach is to say, we're going to take a decision case by case, draw on precedent and draw on the science. And the science tells us it's very likely this is going to work. It's not proven by a double-blind random trial, but it is very likely it will work. And that's the way the UK... So having strategic notice of things that are just over the horizon that might come and hit us next, and there are a lot of them around: global warming, sea level rises, population movements. There are all sorts of things that governments ought to be really working on.
It's interesting because you're talking a lot about probability versus possibility. And interestingly, around that, as you go and weigh up the risks of these potential events, the black swan events, the known unknowns, as you say. And I wanted to ask you a question around this, because at what point does preparedness become paranoia? And I'm curious to ask, how much preparation do you put into some of those things without going so far down the line and into the rabbit hole where you obsessing over something that may not actually happen? Where is that line between preparedness and paranoia?
It's in judgment of the decision, judgments by the decision makers, and yes, their judgment of public mood.
Yes.
Because if you go against public mood, you're going to get, in a democracy, you're going to get into quite a lot of trouble. I mean, I summarize this as a combination of two games theory strategies, Maximil and Minimax. So you want to minimize the maximum harm that some of the things can do. Mm-hmm. And there are some very serious things around. And you've got to spend some money preparing.
Yes.
On the other hand, for most of the risks, it's the other way around. You want to maximize the minimum level of assurance you can give the public. So there are certain things you can do, particularly if you think about natural disasters. Australia, you know about bushfires.
Oh, and we such do.
You can't prevent, or if you tried really to prevent them, you would end up with enormous expenditures. But you can maximize the minimum level of assurance by having fire services, some aviation capable of dousing out certainly the smaller fires. You can have all sorts of precautions for evacuation and so on, which are not expensive. So, and you can have public education so people know what to do when the alert goes up, assuming you've built an alert system that will actually notify people. So if you've done all that, as I'm sure Australia has, you're in not a bad position. But there are some things. I remember in my time, we actually acquired some smallpox vaccine. Mm-hmm. Now, there's no live smallpox anywhere.
Yes.
It exists in test form, as it were, in a number of heavily guarded laboratories. But that was, in a sense, paranoia. We thought at the time, after 9/11, the one thing we really, really don't want is a terrorist breaking in and getting that kind of... So let's take that risk off the table.
Yeah.
So we spent a lot of money. Now, that was probably unnecessary. But it's an example of... There's another example, which is in the public domain, is the large amount of money which was spent protecting nuclear installations.
Yes, indeed.
Even in the post 9/11 mindset, you really, really do not want terrorists coming anywhere near nuclear materials.
Indeed.
Now, it's quite expensive. You have to have armed guards. You pour a lot of concrete, put up a lot of fences. But once you've done that, you've effectively dealt with the risk.
Yes.
Because the chances of a successful attack on nuclear material in the UK vanishingly small. But you can't do that for everything.
No.
So it's a combination of those two approaches.
It's really interesting because one of the things you spoke about was having alert systems in place. And of course, this is a business program. And thankfully, our decisions that we take are not ones of national importance or state safety and all those sorts of things. We'll leave those decisions to people on a higher pay grade. But I'm curious to ask you, in business examples, where you've seen some of these things come unstuck, or indeed where people have used that strategy effectively. Britain's got some incredible businesses and business examples. I'm wondering if you've seen good or bad examples of this in the commercial world.
Well, yes, let me give you one way of approaching this that I got from one of our leading oil companies, because I think every major company in the UK, and I'm sure it's true in Australia, has a risk register.
Yes.
And then if you're a quoted company, you've got to put in the annual report what you've done about your managing your risks and so on. But on its own, a risk register, you produce it to the board and the board sits and looks at it and says, that's, well, good. Have you got things under control? Yes, says the executive. So the neatest trick I've come across is you split the register into three kinds of risk.
Mm-hmm.
And the first kind of risk comes from things you can do nothing about.
Yes.
The currency collapses, you know, the earthquake takes out the plant or whatever it might be. So that's the kind of risk where the questions you ask as the board of the executive are, what are the contingency plans?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fallback arrangement. Where's the data stored so that even if you get taken out, we're not going to lose the company? And that's very straightforward. The second kind of risks are the risks that are endemic in the business. So if you're running retail, you're going to get shrinkage of stock.
Mm.
People nick the stock. If you're running a bank, you're going to get fraud.
Yes.
So these, for those kinds of systemic risks, the questions are about systems of control.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you check the stock? You know.
Yes.
How do you look at people's accounts? How do you detect fraud and so on? And you put the systems in place. But then the third class of risk that are the ones that are really tricky, and those are the self-induced risks. Those are the risks you took on yourself.
Yes.
Because you took your dental practice and you decided you were going to move into brand new premises. Okay, so if that all goes wrong, that's the end of the business.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to think about, actually, which building contractor did we give this to? Was it just the local one? When was the last time we checked up on the delivery of all the new equipment we're going to need, etc.? And you ask very much more pointed and particularly questions about who's in charge of this and how often did we check on it? So that's a long way around, just as saying that risks come in different kinds, and it's quite useful to think about your risks in these different categories, because what you do about them tends to be rather different.
It's a really interesting process because, again, one of the things we talk about in the work that we do is really being clear about the risks that businesses face, and certainly the things that we have in our group of practices. We create a thing called a disaster file, which is probably analogous to the risk register, but I haven't gone through that process of the categorization of three types, which I think is really, really nice.
Do you have what is known in the business as a war chest?
Absolutely. A pile of money.
Yeah, you've got some money. You've got the names and addresses of the staff. You've got a checkbook or credit cards, all the detail you would need to run the business. And it's not on site. It's somewhere. So that, because one of the things we discovered, even when the terrorists launched a rocket attack on the headquarters of the British Secret Service, it bounced off. It did no damage. But it was a crime scene. So the police came and said, right, everyone out. You're not allowed back into the building until we've done all the forensics. And, you know, this is the operational headquarters for the Secret Service. And they hadn't quite thought in advance that they'd be locked out of their own building. I mean, yes, only for a few hours. But you get the idea. So, I mean, if there is a fire or if the business next door
catches fire, indeed. Well, interestingly enough, we took the during COVID, we took the risk precaution of storing our PPE offsite. And so we were worried, frankly, at one point, we were a bit worried about theft of PPE. And so we had ordered great supplies of PPE, but we didn't keep them in the business. We kept them elsewhere, just in case. And that was just one of those strategies. I wanted to just shift gear for a moment. And I wanted to talk about misinformation and disinformation. Firstly, what the difference is. And secondarily, how do you know when you're being hoodwinked? Because I imagine in your line of work, there's a lot of material that is served up that is deliberately false or deliberately incomplete or at least misleading that would lead you to an incorrect or erroneous assumption or conclusion. And so I wanted to ask about that.
Yeah, I've got a couple of chapters in the book about that. There are really three categories. There's misinformation, and that's stuff that's wrong, but innocently so. So you didn't know when the journalist wrote the article, he thought that. So that it then turns out that was wrong. And a decent journalist or a decent politician will stand up in Parliament and say, I'm sorry, I misled you. We now know. So that's innocent. When the information is circulated, it's believed to be correct.
Mm.
Disinformation is the opposite. When it's circulated, the person circulating it or saying it knows that it's wrong.
Mm.
So they are deliberately trying to deceive you. And there's a third category, rather interestingly, come into vogue at the time of the American election, the 2016 election, which is malinformation.
Ooh.
And that's information that's true, but was never intended for public consumption and was stolen and leaked. So this is hack and leak. Mm-hmm. So the Russians' Advanced Persistent Threat Group, Grizzly Step, I think they called them, hacked into the US Democratic Party's committee servers mm-hmm. and stole the emails between leading members of the Democratic Party. And then released them.
Yes.
And these emails were full of personal, you know, insults and anecdotes and slagging off the Republicans and all the sort of stuff you would expect in email exchanges between people who know each other extremely well and imagine that their emails are private. So you break in, you steal them, and then you release them. And the Russians did exactly the same to the President Macron at the time of the French
mm-hmm.
election, and they hacked in and they stole his emails. They took the additional step of tweaking them to make them look more embarrassing.
Oh, wow.
They released them. The French handled it extremely well. They came straight out to the media saying, emails have been hacked into, they've been altered, don't believe a word of it. And certainly the French press did not. It was just before the election. And they didn't really use the material, which is good. I'm not sure the Australian press would have been quite so reserved, nor the British press.
Well, I like
the golden rule, of course, from that is never, ever put anything in a message, an email or whatever that you would be embarrassed to see in public.
That's really interesting. When I have a difficult conversation to have or I've got a difficult message to convey, I much prefer to do it on telephone than any other medium if I can't do it face-to-face for those reasons. I had interestingly enough, my background was as a Navy dentist. And of course, as a dentist, we'd had no access to anything particularly sensitive. But we did have a lot of training around making sure that we were using the information on the servers securely and so on. And it's just an old habit that I got into from years ago. You never put anything in writing that you don't want anyone to see. It's just something that stuck with me from years. In your book, you give lots of examples of where thinking has gone awry. And one of the things I really enjoyed about How Spies Think was the anecdotes and the stories. And there's lots of anecdotes there. I wanted to talk a little bit about zigging and zagging a little bit here, but going back to assumptions and testing that information, because you spoke about the weapons of mass destruction and the evidence to support the case, but equally there was an analyst who dared to raise the question that the information may not be correct. And she was, well, shouted down is probably my language, not yours. But I'm wondering how to have someone challenge our information, but also do it in a way that's received well. How to take that, and then, of course, if you're the person delivering it, how to deliver that additional information?
It's a great question. It's a real issue all the way up to prime ministers. And when things go wrong, you very often discover that afterwards people knew that there were problems.
Yes.
But they dared put their head above the parapet and actually say, boss, I think you're going, that's not going to work. And there are some, again, write about this a little bit in the book, that one of the key ideas is the safe space.
Mm.
So if you're in charge of something, you need a safe space, a place and a time where you can have a conversation with the staff or the advisors or whoever, in which they, you know, truths can genuinely be told. And it takes a bit of work to create the trust that you need for that kind of conversation, where people won't feel it's held against them or they'll be thought to be too negative because they're saying the boss's great idea is actually not such a great idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are ways of putting it over. What you don't do is ever, if you want to be heard, is to embarrass the boss in front of other people.
Indeed.
Outsiders. But if you've got a team, you need to get the team together, and the team's got to be free to have a real discussion. At the end, the boss can then gather the threads together and say, right, I've heard you all. This is what we're going to do. And you may get another protest, but at some point, the boss has got to make a decision. You've got to say, this is the way we're going. But provided it's been evident that the boss has actually genuinely been listening, and has tried to understand where the dissident voice is coming from and what evidence there might be, then you'll get good results.
Mm.
Sadly, it's when people become a bit cut off, particularly as they get more and more senior, and therefore they're surrounded by a court of people who are more and more anxious to say things that won't trigger the outburst of temper from the boss or whatever. Those are the situations that are really dangerous.
I think there's a lot in there that anyone in the world can take away from, but particularly business owners. Dave, you've been really, really generous with your time. And firstly, thank you so much for that. Your book, House Buyers Think, is wonderful. And I'd like to ask one final question, if I may, because I think it's something that you would have encountered, you would have dealt with, and indeed probably all of us have dealt with. And you've touched on, you've given us the framework, but I wanted to ask you about the role of emotions and intuition and all those sorts of things in decision-making, because when things don't feel right, but you can't find the evidence to suggest otherwise, and as you said earlier, it's about sometimes choosing the course of action which has the least evidence against it. I wanted to ask you, I guess it's a double-barreled question. One is, how do you take intuition into your reasoning? And secondarily, when you're dealing with stressful situations, as I imagine many of the prime ministers have had to deal with that you've worked with, how do you keep your faculties sharp when you're dealing with high-stakes decisions?
Very good question. The first thing I'd say is, as I was saying right at the beginning of our conversation, you need the emotional side and you need the rational side, and you've got to bring them together. Churchill in 1940, if he'd followed a sort of cost-benefit analysis, would have done a deal with Germany.
Yeah.
Because Britain was on its own. Our armed forces were under-equipped. Everything, you know, looked really perilous. Why risk all that by sticking out on your own? So you need the emotional bit. But of course, what Churchill then did was pay attention to all the detail, you know, the code breakers at Bletchley Park, the aircraft production, replacing most of the generals with people who had fire in their belly. I mean, that sort of attention to detail. So even if you are in the end saying, no, I know the rational analysis, this is not the rational thing to do, but we are going my way, then you really, it behoves you, you really got to make sure that this is not magical thinking, that you're connected. I describe it sometimes as building a wall from the top row of bricks downwards. So you hold up the top row of bricks with faith, as it were, and you just hope that somebody's going to eventually get all the way down to the foundation. That is not, generally speaking, a good way to build a wall. But sometimes you just have to follow the instinct, but don't leave it at that, would be my answer to that part of the question. And the other part of it is, if you don't have to think fast, then take your time. Not delay decisions for their own sake. But I've often found that just taking a few hours out to say to the team, look, let's take a break, go for a walk, let's come back and reassess. Suddenly it all looks a bit simpler. Or sleep on it overnight and the solution comes whilst you're asleep, and the next morning when you're fresh, it doesn't seem quite so daunting. You can think yourself into a sort of fatigue battle mentality that probably, you know, yes, if the enemy's coming over the hill directly at you, but in most situations, you've got time to think about it and, as far as possible, to follow the SEAS model. You know, do you really understand what you're up against? Have you got as much information? Interesting. I read somewhere that Elon Musk, who I think is probably still the world's richest man, was reported as saying, take the decision when you've got 70% of the information you think you ought to have. And that kind of sounds about right.
Yeah.
If you wait till for perfection, till you've got everything in your rational analysis signed, sealed, and delivered, you've probably missed the moment. But if you just plunge in, chances are you're out of your depth.
I really love that 70% metaphor. I hadn't heard Elon Musk say that, but I think as dentists, we are prone to wanting certainty. Well, I was going to say certainty 100% of the time, and of course that doesn't exist. And so what tends to happen for a lot of people who are wired a bit like us as dentists is we're looking for every single dot to line up, every single T to be crossed, every, you know, I dotted. And I think that you're absolutely right. You missed the moment. And I can certainly think of a few times in my life where I've been waiting for that extra piece of the puzzle. And by the time it arrived, the opportunity had passed me by. And I think of that quite regularly. So, David, you've been incredibly generous with your time today. And firstly, I want to say thank you for writing the book, How Spies Think. It is available on Amazon and it's available through Penguin Booksellers around the world. Here in Australia, you can grab it in any good bookstore. It's a wonderful read. Not only is it really instructive and practical and useful, it's also incredibly entertaining. And so I just want to personally say thank you so much for putting pen to paper around that. I don't know how long exactly it took you to write, but I imagine that there was a lot of work and effort that went into that. And so thank you so much for taking the time to put pen to paper.
Thanks for inviting me. It's been a great conversation. I've enjoyed it.
I've enjoyed it a great deal as well. So thank you once again, and I hope we can catch up again another time.
Thanks for that.
Thank you. Bye for now.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/Savvy Dentist.